This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for joining us. Dave Flessner is business editor at the Chattanooga Times Free Press. We caught up with him recently to talk about a few of his stories, one on the future for electric power in the Tennessee Valley, and the other on the prospects for Chattanooga's economy beyond the pandemic. Dave, thanks for joining us.
It's good to be with you again, Ray.
Tell us more about what you have written. Is this power shift in the Tennessee Valley, the relations between TVA and local utilities, such as our own EPB here in Chattanooga?
Well, the Tennessee Valley Authority, of course, was created as part of the New Deal in 1933, and it was the wholesale supplier. It harnessed the power of the river and provided power in the seven state regions that it serves. But it's distributed, and the individual customer who gets their electricity gets it from either a municipality like EPB or many of the power cooperatives like North Georgia Electric, Volunteer Energy, and others. So there are 154 of those across the Tennessee Valley area. And those are the ones who've taken TVA's wholesale power and distributed it. And throughout its whole history, TVA has been the power supplier, and the municipalities and power co-ops have been the distributors and had to buy all their power from TVA. A few of them have left from time to time, but fundamentally that number has stayed the same, and they've relied entirely on TVA. Well, as we move into a new era of energy distribution where solar and wind and renewable energy, there's both more demand for it. So customers want to make sure that they can buy renewable energy. And there's the reduced cost of producing that so that you can now produce solar sometimes cheaper than you could potentially get it from TVA at particular times when the sun shines. So TVA is now working out a new arrangement. They're giving some flexibility and allowing distributors like EPB or the power co-ops to produce anywhere from 3 to 5% of their own power. So historically, they've never produced power. They've just taken power from TVA and distributed it along the transmission lines, put it into your house or your business. So the role is really changing a little bit, and distributors, EPB and others, are being able to get into battery storage to produce, maybe build their own solar farm to a limited extent. And this all comes as, at the same time, TVA is trying to make long-term contracts with these distributors. So they have a 20-year agreement that they'll stay with them. And so that relationship between the Tennessee Valley Authority and all these municipalities and co-ops, it's an interesting time. So we've got this flexibility now that we may see more distributed power. Solar power, we can either produce on our own rooftops for individuals, but sometimes distributors and small municipalities can begin to aggregate some solar farms and make their own power to help them meet peak demand. And then TVA itself is even making huge solar farms at utility scale solar. So we're seeing a real shift as we move from big baseload nuclear power, coal-fired power plants, to the ability with wind and solar to produce power at a much more localized, distributed level, and more demand for that. We're seeing Facebook, Amazon, General Motors even have made commitments to go carbon free. And as such, they want to make sure that all of their electricity is produced in a carbon free way. So they don't want coal power, they don't want natural gas power, they want power produced by solar. So we're seeing a range of ways in which both power co-ops and TVA are providing that.
Are there any fault lines here, or is this just a matter of TVA is trying to adjust to how technology in the market is changing, and so are these local utilities?
There's a big challenge in all of this. Can distributors produce their power? They've not done that before. And then is TVA really the best and lowest cost, because they've invested heavily in these main baseload power generating facilities, billions and billions in their nuclear plants, but now solar gets cheaper, and it may be the distributed energy is more efficient and better, and there may be alternatives. So we're seeing some of the 154 municipalities and power co-ops that are in the TVA fold are looking at their options, and some of them are even looking at leaving TVA, including the very largest customer, the Memphis Gas, Light, and Water, which is now studying the option of leaving TVA after more than 70 years and potentially going and buying from other power sources or generating their own power. In our region, Volunteer Energy up in Decatur, North Georgia Electric down in Dalton and North Georgia area, they're both looking potentially of leaving TVA. Maybe they'll get their wholesale power from different sources. So a more competitive market. TVA has always had this monopoly within the seven state area that it has, and we're now seeing some challenges to that. Most of the distributors, EPB and others, have made the judgment that they're going to stick with TVA. They've signed the 20-year agreement. They're going to use some of this flexibility, and they're basically all in with the public power model as we've had it for nearly a century. But for some, they're looking at some options, and we may see some split in the TVA family.
And these large tech firms that are already based in this area and are looking to deepen their footprint in this area, but also concerned about their carbon footprint, that's a wild card in this, isn't it?
Absolutely. So Facebook and Amazon, as I said, GM, even Vanderbilt University have all made commitments to go carbon free. So TVA, in some cases, is building solar farms dedicated just to those sources. Some cases, the local distributor is. In some cases, we may see them do it themselves as well. Facebook is now getting $800 million data processing center, and TVA is building a 70 megawatt solar farm to supply that. Just 2012, when Volkswagen came here, the 8-megawatt solar farm that's out there was the largest solar farm in Tennessee at the time. Now, this new solar farm they're building for Facebook will be 10 times as large. We're seeing a lot bigger and more solar farms as solar costs come down and as more people want to go carbon free, as they become more concerned about climate change.
Does this shake out at all in what people see in their utility bill?
It can very much, because the question is, what is the best long-term, lowest-cost power solution? And TVA has controlled that and will continue to set rates even in this new model for those that sign on with TVA. But as we say, some of the power co-ops and municipalities are looking at potentially getting cheaper power from other sources. So they're looking at trying to deliver power at the lower cost. One of the challenges is solar and wind is great when the sun shines or the wind blows, and it's very cheap, even cheaper than TVA. But then you need somebody to have that backup power to provide power during the nighttime or during peak demand periods, or to have that infrastructure that supplies that. So who pays for the fixed cost of all the transmission system and the delivery? Who pays for that marginal cost? That's the dance that's going on now in the great negotiations that continue between TVA and its customers and its distributors. And TVA, which was still lower than most of the country, is not necessarily the lowest cost source of power. There are some other options that Memphis and North Georgia Electric and Volunteer finding in the region, some other wholesale suppliers that are a bit cheaper. So they're looking around and they may be leaving TVA as a consequence to try to lower their cost for their customers. TVA's mission is always to provide the lowest cost, but they also have to be reliable. And so that question of reliability and cost enter into all of this. And we don't know where the future really lies. How much cheaper can solar get? How much more efficient can solar panels get? They continue to drive down costs. The future is very interesting and changing. And it all comes in an era when people are not increasing their power demand as much as they once did. Every new water heater and furnace and air conditioning unit is more efficient than the one it replaces. So the power load that used to grow as much as 6 or 7% a year in the valley, and people getting more and more electric appliances, even as we have more electronic devices in our home, total electric consumption has been pretty flat or even declining. And so as we get other sources of power, we may not need as much of these massive coal and nuclear plants as we once did.
Let's talk about another story that you have written about the development pipeline here in Chattanooga going forward despite COVID-19 and the economic impact of the lockdown. What do you find?
Very interesting. You would have thought that certainly Chattanooga, like most cities, has been hit pretty hard. I think we're in the last month for which data is available in June, we were 20,000 fewer jobs, 8% fewer jobs than a year ago, in that a lot of people are obviously still laid off or on furlough or not getting their job opportunities. But that said, there's a lot of interest in people moving to Chattanooga. And we're a logistics capital. We've got well located within a day's drive of about half the U.S. population. We've got a lower cost of living, taxes, energy. So all those tend to be attractive. And in the COVID era, there's some desire maybe that people are looking at, instead of having to have downtown offices in big cities like New York or Chicago or Atlanta, they may go to mid-sized cities that are a little bit more comfortable and are more affordable. And social distancing is a little easier in Chattanooga than it is in Manhattan, perhaps, where, as you know very well yourself, right? So it's a great outdoor city. And so there's some attractiveness to that. So the Chamber of Commerce is actually finding that they've actually had more prospects, or at least people they're talking to about relocating here right now than they did a year ago, even before the pandemic, which is really quite extraordinary. So that doesn't mean they're all coming here, but there has been some interest. We've seen a couple of companies, one moved from New Hampshire down here. So a couple of companies, some scattered evidence of that. Individuals too can work anywhere they want now. You know, we suddenly move from a model where we have to drive economic development by bringing businesses here with remote work and workers, and many companies now able to work wherever they want. You can live in Chattanooga, an attractive place to live, lower cost living perhaps than it is in some big cities, and do your work from here. So that may attract workers and people moving here, all of which would foster economic growth in a way that Chattanooga may be poised to do a bit better than many cities, and even in this challenging era that we're in.
Do we have a handle on what types of jobs might be here for these people, or what jobs these people might be bringing from elsewhere?
That's a great question. Some of what the chamber is saying is that, like most of the economy, these jobs require a bit more skills than a lot of the ones that are being phased out. Certainly retailing and a lot of traditional low-skilled factory work is being phased out either by automation or in the current era, you know, online e-commerce is driving a lot of the retail jobs out. So there's a shift, and to be sure, there are many jobs that probably won't be coming back. But jobs in tech areas, as we go to remote work and technology and we do things online, there's opportunities there. And many companies are redefining themselves, certainly in this era, and finding they need different kinds of work. And so skill levels probably need to be more. We need probably more white collar work than blue collar work in demand. So that becomes a challenge for Chattanooga because traditionally our educational level has not been as high as some areas. So that's something we have to continue to work on. I know city and county leaders are trying to work on that challenge. And so worker skills and development becomes even more important, I think, as we move forward.
It seems like it's another example of trends that were already in motion that were magnified and accelerated by the pandemic.
Precisely. I don't know if there's anything new, but I think it just puts everything on steroids and moves it much quicker than we would have ever anticipated. Certainly the office isn't the office of the past, but now we've got where some people won't even have offices. FreightWaves and other companies have decided here in Chattanooga, they don't even need to have their workers come to office. They can work remotely all the time. And even now, 5 months into this, we have some of the major employers in our town, TVA, Unum, Blue Cross, and others, where a majority of their workers are still at home working remotely. Changes we would have thought would have taken several years were compressed now in a few months' time. So it really is accelerating the pace of what we already were seeing. And that creates some real challenges, but some opportunities for Chattanooga as well.
All right, Dave, thanks so much.
Great to be with you. Thanks.
Liz Norell teaches political science at Chattanooga State Community College. She is sharing her knowledge of how government on all levels works in a virtual series of classes now underway, hosted by the Chattery.
Liz, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm happy to be here.
What a time to host a series of classes on civics.
Well, and to be honest, we scheduled this because we know that the elections are coming up and people are even more interested in them than usual. And we specifically designed this series so that it will finish just before or just as early voting starts in Tennessee, so that people who are preparing to vote can feel more educated about doing so.
You've had one class already. Tell us more.
Yes.
About that.
The first class, which was just a few days ago, was an overview of how we run elections in the United States. We started with primaries and caucuses and then talked about the Electoral College, just to get a sense of the way that those are structured. We had a really good discussion about some of the potential unintended consequences if we were to just get rid of the Electoral College.
What's one unintended consequence?
Just to be clear, this is all speculation because nobody really knows what would happen because it's never happened. But my suspicion is that in a world without an Electoral College, we would see much, much more money being pumped into presidential elections because the candidates would have to campaign in very expensive media markets where currently they don't have to, like New York, like Houston, like Chicago. We sort of assume that those markets, we know how they're going to vote. And so there's no need to run very expensive ads in those markets. So one of the things that I worry about is in a world without an Electoral College, we see exponentially more money involved, which is not something that I'm super excited about personally.
And at the same time, we have received an education about the Electoral College at work in more than one election in the past generation where the candidate who prevailed in the Electoral College did not win the popular vote.
Quite true. And, you know, that's something that I think has, for many people, created some interesting ideas about why the Electoral College was created the way it was that are perhaps not particularly grounded in the historical record of why we have an Electoral College. I remember after the 2016 election being at a restaurant. So I live in Monteagle and I was at a local restaurant and I heard some people at the next table talking about how the Electoral College was created to make sure that people who lived in cities didn't overrule people who lived in rural communities. And I thought, well, that's a very nice post hoc justification, but it's not particularly well grounded in the historical record.
The next class that you have coming up is on gerrymandering.
gerrymandering, or if you want to be persnickety about it, gerrymandering, because of course gerrymandering comes from a man named Elbridge Gerry in New England, who was one of the pioneers in drawing districts to predispose electoral outcomes in his favor. So this class will talk about what redistricting is and how that process works, and what gerrymandering is and how it's just a particular kind of redistricting.
And this is particularly important now because we have been talking about the census, and it is the information from the census that leads to the drawing of legislative districts, of congressional districts, and gerrymandering is an abuse of that process.
Well, I might quibble with the use of the word abuse. It is one particular kind of use. It's certainly not illegal, and everybody does it on both sides. So I'm not sure that it's an improper use, but I think when people learn about it, many Americans feel like it's probably not the way we want our districts to be drawn.
And then the next class that you have, and then after the class on gerrymandering, you have a class on Chattanooga and Hamilton County government. And we've talked a little bit about this before.
Yeah, so we're going to do three different workshops that look at different levels of government. We've got one on local, and that one we really talk about the difference between city versus county government and how they work together and how they have different responsibilities. And, you know, in that one, we get a lot of questions about which government does what and what are we electing people to do on our behalf. So that one's really fun because we often get a lot of people at those workshops, the local government ones, who actually have some experience working for local government. And that's fun for me because I get to hear the perspective of people who are actually working in government.
And we saw the differences between city government and county government in the past few months in the response to COVID-19 and the debate about mask mandates and who had the final say on guidelines.
Not only did we see some discrepancy between city and county, we saw some differences between elected officials with independent spheres of authority at the same level of government. So we had Hamilton County Mayor Jim Coppinger requiring masks, but then the sheriff not enforcing that and local police feeling like they had to try to decide which side they were on. And so, yeah, that all comes down to local politics and local spheres of influence. And that's really fascinating.
And that leads us to the class after that, which is about state of Tennessee government.
I want to kind of link back to something we were just talking about on gerrymandering. It is the state legislature that will oversee and approve districting maps. And this has a profound impact on so many parts of our lives. So the state government, I think, is especially important for us to be paying attention to as we go into the November election this year, because the people that we elect will be the ones who will oversee the redistricting process next year.
And from what has been reported, it seems that Tennessee will retain the same number of representatives in the U.S. House. But still, how are those districts drawn? And the same goes for districts in the General Assembly.
That's exactly right. I don't know if we have specific numbers yet to know exactly what the number of congressional seats will be, but I don't expect there to be big changes for Tennessee. But you're absolutely right. The state legislature draws congressional districts, but also state house districts, county commission districts. All of those different redistricting plans go through the state legislature for approval. And so they're largely drawn by local people, but they have to go through an approval process. And so the stakes of those state elections are just incredibly important in any election, but especially in elections in years that end in zero, like this year.
And what happens in Tennessee will not happen in a vacuum, because some of our neighbors have seen changes and will see more changes unfold in their demographics. I'm thinking of North Carolina. I'm thinking of Georgia, and how the same process for drawing districts in those states may impact what lawmakers in Tennessee decide to do.
That's right. And in North Carolina, especially in the last cycle, they have been through several rounds of lawsuits related to decisions that that state's legislature made around the drawing of districts. And in 2010, there was some discussion, I don't know how serious it was, but there was some discussion in the Tennessee legislature about doing some fairly radical shifts in the drawing of districts for Tennessee, such that the constituencies in Shelby County, which is Memphis, and in Davidson County, which is Nashville, were more spread out so that the two Democrats who serve in the Tennessee delegation of the House might have a harder time winning those seats. That was eventually shot down, and those two seats remain largely districted such that Democrats can be competitive and, in fact, have continued to hold those seats. But there's no guarantee that the state legislature would continue to do that.
And then we have the final class in October on the federal government.
Yes. And one of the things that I like to focus on in that particular class is what the powers of the presidency are, but perhaps just as importantly, what the powers of the presidency are not. And thinking about some of the myths that we have around what the president can and cannot do, that's some of the most interesting content for my students at Chad State and also for the people in that particular workshop. So that's always a fun conversation.
What's something that most people may not know about the real powers of the presidency or the Congress or the Supreme Court that they should know?
One thing that I always like to stress, and this is something of a personal crusade of mine, is that we tend to think that the president has a lot more control over the economy than I would argue he does. It is true that the president has some very limited discretion over a small amount of spending, and the president, through his words, can influence the general level of trust of Americans in the state of the economy. But in terms of actually having access to the levers that control our economy, the president has very little. And this is something that kind of gets me worked up no matter who's in the Oval Office and what they're claiming. People who today want to credit Trump for a great economy are just as infuriating to me as people who criticized George W. Bush for being president during a downturn in the economy. Because the truth is, neither of those presidents has really earned the blame or the credit for what the economy is doing.
A portion of the proceeds from all the classes in this series will go to Chattanooga State's First in the Family Scholarship. Tell us more about that.
At Chattanooga State, we have a large number of students who are first-generation college students. This is a population that's near and dear to my heart because they sit in my classes, and they're often people who don't have role models in their life who can help them navigate college. And so choosing to donate my time for these workshops so that we can provide more scholarship dollars for that particular population is very important to me. So these students apply for scholarships. We also have an annual fundraiser. This is a big initiative of Chat State to make college more accessible and affordable to first generation college students. So I'm happy that a portion of what we earn from these workshops will go to support those scholarships.
And all of these classes that you are teaching through the Chattery online have a suggested donation of $10. A portion of the proceeds, as we've been saying, go to Chattanooga State's First in the Family Scholarship. And for people who want more information and want to participate, they can go to thechattery.org. If people want to connect with you beyond the classes, how can they reach you?
The best way is probably just to email me, and my email address has an obnoxiously large number of letters in it, but it's elizabeth.norell, and my last name is spelled N-O-R-E-L-L, at chattanoogastate.edu. And I welcome questions anytime. I really see my job as bringing more information about how government works to everyone, including the people in my classroom. So if listeners have questions, please reach out anytime.
All right, Liz, thanks so much.
I appreciate it, Ray. Thank you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots. More in a moment. This is Scenic Roots. I'm Ray Bassett. George Singleton of Spartanburg, South Carolina, is a storyteller who peers into human nature with a sharp wit. You Want More is his new collection of 30 short stories from 8 books over 20 years as a published author. George, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you so much. Thank you, Ray. I'm happy to be connected to Chattanooga again.
Tell me how you got into writing.
Yeah, weird question. Weird answer coming up. You know, I was brought up in a small town in South Carolina called Greenwood. There wasn't a bookstore there. A library maybe had 15 or 20 books. You know how everybody in the South, any writer in the South always says, well, I started reading William Faulkner when I was 10 years old. And my mentor was Henry Gibson. He was on Laugh-In, this TV show Laugh-In. He came out with a big flower and said these weird poems. I thought, that guy's funny. And in high school, and I wasn't a big reader, But in high school, you know, I read those things like Wuthering Heights and Charles Dickens and, you know, all those really depressing things. I thought, good golly. And when I went to college, I went to this place called Furman University. I had some professors say, hey, you might want to read this. You got a kind of weird sense of humor. And so I was reading Donald Barthelmay and John Barth and Thomas Pynchon and Eugene Ionesco, Harold Pinter, and Samuel Beckett. And I went, God, these guys are funny. Samuel Beckett's not all that funny. He's kind of sad. But I think I can do this, like an idiot, you know. But then I just started writing. I don't know. I read a novel called The Sotweed Factor by John Barth that was funny, real long novel, and not particularly well known, I don't think. And I just thought, I'm going to try this. And then, because I'm real hard-headed, even when I was writing early on, I knew when things were bad, but I was going to finish it. So I'd finish and just start something else. I didn't start writing short stories until I was 28. I wrote three horrifically execrable novels between 21 and 28.
You had to get those out of your system.
I think so. And, you know, it came, every professor I had said, you're ready after 1,000 pages. And that first one was 450 pages. The second was 250. The third was 300. And I'm no math genius, but that comes to 1,000.
In what you write, there is tragedy, there is comedy, and there is just the downright absurd.
Yeah, I'm a little bit attracted to the absurd, and always have been since reading those playwrights. And I don't know, you know, my father had a 10th grade education. He was in the Merchant Marines, and he had some bad, he fell 45 feet into the hold of a ship. So, and he lived and had a lot of operations and a lot of hip replacements. But he lived every day like it might be the last day on earth. And he had kind of a jaundiced eye toward a lot of things. Anybody with authority, you know, anybody with a lot of money, et cetera. And that just kind of filtered into my skin somehow, I think.
And then there's the balance between those ingredients, the tragedy, the comedy, the absurd. And how do you find your way there to the right recipe?
Yeah, who knows? I just thought up this new analogy the other day. It's kind of like I can make a meal that has an entree, sides, and all that. And sometimes, a couple, two or three times, they all work out. But a lot of times, I'm just stuck on starches. You know, I'm just going to do all starches. Or sometimes I'm just, okay, here's all the meats. But sometimes I get the meat, the starch, the vegetables, the dessert, all right. And that's the reason I write, is just trying to write a good story, you know. The tragedy comedy thing, I usually start off with a comedic premise or an absurdist premise, or, you know, a guy in a real man or woman in a really uncomfortable situation, and it might be funny, but then sometimes it just ends up being sad because they realize they cannot attain what they're trying to attain, I assume, you know, or they do attain what they're trying to attain and find out, uh-oh, maybe I didn't want this.
Such as the father who takes his son to visit the many ex-girlfriends that could have been his mother.
Sure. Started off, I thought, you know, I was trying to be funny. And I think that's kind of a funny premise. The father's trying to do the best he can, he thinks. The son is perplexed and just wants to give his Father's Day, and he wants to give his dad this special present, a set of hex keys or Allen wrenches. And the father's like, I really don't need anything. There's a lot of love between that father and son. But then at the end, it's just kind of, there's a sadness in that father, I think, you know, who I think is just saying, I'm a single dad doing the best I can.
And then there's the romance between the librarian and the professional bowler while they're competing to win an RV.
Yeah. Actually, that story came about because about, well, 5 years ago, my mother died. And I'm an only child. This is a mother who's from Muskegon, Michigan. And so I was left with a lot of stuff. And I didn't need or want all of it. I don't have any kids. Glenda, my wife, doesn't, you know. She took what she wanted, and I sold some estate jewelry to this place. I won't mention it. And then I was on book tour doing stuff, and the phone rang. As a matter of fact, I was going down to right below Chattanooga, like Rainesville, Alabama, or so I was going to do some kind of thing there. So the phone rang, and I answered, and Glenda said, you're not going to be happy. Go look on the website of this jeweler where you sold the estate jewelry, where he told you it wasn't worth any money, and he was selling it for about 10 times what he had paid me. I understand twice as much, but not 10. I let the guy know when I got back home. I said, you know, I think you kind of cheated me a little bit. You took advantage of me. And he said, well, you can come back and buy it for what we paid you, which is kind. But I thought, I'd rather just write a story and just kind of make fun of you and have somebody crash an RV. And then I had to figure out how to get the RV crashed into the place, you know. I had to work that story kind of backwards.
Back into it.
Yeah. No pun intended.
What do you think people miss? What do you think people get wrong about the South when we're talking about the literature of the South?
Yeah. Well, some people think that Southern literature is all grandma in the rocking chair on the front porch spinning tales. And that may have been 50 to 100 years ago. Southern literature is really diverse, more than people think. And you have kind of these little, you know, you got the Appalachian literature, Appalachian noir, you got low country literature, you got that deep South literature of Mississippi, Alabama. I don't know. I think basically any writer worth his or her salt is just trying to tell a story that people could in the Pacific Northwest or New England could say, oh yeah, that rings a bell to me too. Even though if it's Maine, somebody in Maine and someone's writing a story that involves high school football and barbecue and deer hunting, person in Maine might say, yeah, that sounds a lot like here, except it's hockey, moose, I don't know what they eat, and clam chowder. Yeah.
That sounds right. I've been there.
I had to pull that one out, Ray. That was a tough one to come up with off the top of my head.
We got past the finish line. That's all right. What you write about and the way you write it, the people that you focus on, these characters, there's really no such thing as a minor character. They might seem minor on that first sentence, that first paragraph, that first page, but where you take them and what that reveals about them, nothing minor about that.
You're the second person that's told me this, and especially about this book. Maybe a month ago, someone said something about these minor characters are not minor. And I've never thought about it. I mean, they're secondary characters, but you know, if they're in the story, they need to have some importance. You can't just have someone show up and then walk off stage immediately. They have to do something to help drive the narrative forward, you know, I hope.
And these characters, they are from the South. They are blue collar men and women. They're just struggling to make sense of the world and struggling to live their lives.
Yeah, a lot of times I'll have blue collar characters who are educated or a little bit more liberal than, let's say, the average South Carolinian, and just trying to make sense out of the world. I mean, that's, you know, that's what we should all be doing. I mean, and I don't want to bring politics up because it only gets me in trouble, but I'm kind of having a hard time making sense of the world right now. I think everybody else is. It's real hard to write humor. Talk about trying to write comedy. With all the absurdity going on, I don't have anything to write about except read the newspaper.
Even Will Rogers might have been challenged by today.
I think Will Rogers would have just gone off into the sunset, you know, gone and retired in Missouri or wherever.
Do you have any favorites among the stories in this collection?
I'm not being coy. When I write a story and send it off, and let's say it might get rejected 10 times or might get accepted, I kind of forget about it after it's already published or in a book. But so a lot of times someone will say to me, you remember? So I'm just praying, Ray, that you don't mention some character. And I go, I don't know what you're talking about. But that story, Show and Tell, it's another dad and lad story. It's about a father who keeps giving his son these things to take to show and tell in the third grade or whatever. And it keeps doing it. And what they end up being is the kid's teacher is the father's ex-girlfriend from high school. And the reason why I like that story is because I wrote that in about 1999 or 2000. So I was already 40, 42. It was a big shift. It was a first person retrospective. It was an adult narrator looking back and saying, you know, when I was 8 years old, I had this crazy father. And I really enjoyed telling those stories because I kind of have a lot from my own life. They're just fun to write. And I remember that one because it seemed to be a breakthrough in voice for one. You know, no one wants to hear a story from a 6-year-old kid written like a 6-year-old kid or 5-year-old kid. Me want a lollipop. No, 5-year-old probably wouldn't talk like that, but it's easy. You can, in this first person retrospective, you use adult language, except maybe in dialogue, but the kid might say, and then I said to my dad, I know you're doing something, you're up to something wrong, Dad, but I'll go ahead with it. He can't use some big word. I mean, a 6-year-old can't say, I know you're doing something horrifically terrible father. Ergo, I'm going to go along with it. You can't talk like that, but you get to do a mixture.
Who do you keep going back to read?
I get about six or eight. So there's another thing that really changed for me is Flannery O'Connor. I did not read, you know, when those three novels I was talking to you about earlier that was just god awful. One was set in Nice, France, because I'd spent 10 days in Nice, France. And one was set in Washington, D.C., because I'd spent 9 months there. And one was set in Memphis, Tennessee. I'd never even been to Memphis, but I had a map of the place. So I would just say, Beale Street seems kind of important. And I kept having people say, you know, George, no offense, but you keep writing about these places you don't really know about. You're from a small ex-cotton mill town in South Carolina, write about small towns. And I thought, nothing exciting could happen in small towns. What could happen? And then I started reading Flannery O'Connor. I was not an English major in college. I've studied philosophy. I'm still lagging in my reading. But when I read Flannery O'Connor, is that, oh man, now I get it. You know, when you read all her, think about all, she only lived to be 39, all those great stories. So there's her. Oddly enough, the other is a Northeastern writer named John Cheever. John Cheever, he wrote some odd experimental short stories like The Enormous Radio, The Swimmer. I have a story in this collection about a guy in The Swimmer, I forget his name, Nettie Merrill maybe, swims home through pool after pool after pool in his neighborhood across the county. And I have a guy who gets on his riding lawnmower and cuts a swath across the county in his riding lawnmower because he's dead. He's just riding on it dead till he crashes into a silo and people are, oh, you know. So I was kind of doing a little metafiction thing there. But John Cheever can figure out how to go from point A to point C. You know, a lot of times I'll go, okay, I need to get over here somewhere, but I don't know how to do it. I'll go back and read John Cheever. You know, I'll go read Country Husband or that Enormous Radio. I think is great. Oddly enough, John Cheever, I'm pointing here, for 3 months lived about 1 mile from where I'm sitting right now because he was stationed in Spartanburg at Camp Croft Army Base back in the 40s. In his biography, it was about a one-page section. Actually, he wrote a letter home and said Spartanburg was a town filled with wild razorbacks and people so lazy they won't go to a free parade on Sunday. For language, for just like, just utter, man, how does that guy write a sentence? It's a guy named Barry Hanna, who's passed away, but it was down in Mississippi. He's another go-to guy. Guy said I had six or eight. Off the top of my head, those are like the three that I can just go to. Yeah.
What about younger writers in this region? Who has caught your eye? Who do you pay attention to?
I'm going to have to tiptoe around this one. I just read a book by a woman named Leah Hampton. She lives in Western North Carolina. It's one of the best books of short stories I've read in a long time. I think the title is great, but I can't say it on radio. Well, if you go to your bookstore, you just say, hey, can I get this? And say it. But I think if you're trying to order it online, you might have to actually use that asterisk. But it is a great story. Every first sentence of that is just plows ahead. I mean, it's great. There's a guy down in New Orleans, but he's from Mississippi, named M.O. Walsh. His name is Neil Walsh, but he goes by M.O. Walsh. And he, I don't know how old Neil is. He's 30s. And I think his new novel is called The Big Door Prize. It's not out yet. Oh, there's a ton. And I get embarrassed because I read them and I go, you know, I'm always thinking, oh, they're going to be writing stories about technology or TikTok or something that I just don't understand or care about, and they don't. Buddy of mine, David Joy. David Joy is also from Western North Carolina, and his new book is called, I think it's called When These Mountains Burn. He's written The Weight of the World. He's putting out a novel a year, and he's writing in this Appalachian noir kind of style. Not detective stories, but they're also just good blue-collar mountain people doing the best they can with what they got living in crystal meth kind of area, you know. I still consider Silas House young, so I'll put him in there too.
I don't think he'll argue with you.
Silas is young, you know.
Where can people go online to follow everything that you do beyond this collection?
I hate to say it, but you'd look on Amazon. I think I've got about 11, I think I got 11 or 12 books. I've kind of forgotten. I'm not being weird about that. Two of them are novels. They're not good novels. As a matter of fact, one is called Novel, and it's about a guy named Novel. That's his name. And he's writing a long poem. And I did it kind of as a joke. Back then I was with this publishing house called Harcourt, and I was kind of being urged to write a novel. Maybe I was drinking a little bit too much back then, Ray, but I thought, all right, a novel, I'm going to call it novel and blah, blah, blah. And it's a hairy, metafictional, you kind of need to know some stuff about James Joyce, oddly enough, to maybe understand some of the allusions. Then I wrote a kind of normal novel called Work Shirts for Mad Men, but short stories are kind of my thing, you know. For these crazy Zoom virtual book signing things, I would go to hubcity.com. I'm not very good at self-PR, whatever that is. I kind of hate it. I kind of want to just hide, you know, and write my stuff and just go hide. But that's not the way of the world. It hasn't been for many. If I sold a million books, I could do that. I could be J.D. Salinger, but it looks like that ain't going to happen.
Not yet, anyway.
never.
All right. George, thank you so much.
Thank you, Ray. I really enjoyed talking to you.
You're listening to Scenic Roots on WUTC. I'm Ray Bassett. Thanks for listening to Scenic Roots. We come to you from WUTC at the University of Tennessee at Chattanooga. Email us at scenicroots423@gmail.com. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter at scenicroots423. Listen to us online anytime at WUTC.org and the WUTC app. For Richard Winham and the rest of our team, join us again next time for Scenic Roots.